It's so nice when people come back again. It's very, very reassuring. Obviously, do want what's happening. That's good. Okay, so talk a little bit this morning. I've got some quotes, which always gets me going in the morning. I have a new mnemonic. And it's because several of you said how much you appreciated when I used the word shy for our awareness, you know, our wise parts of ourselves. And just that image that it's kind of waiting in the wings kind of sense, and the other is so interfering. It's a beautiful image. So shy is a mnemonic I've made. So, the mnemonic is just for practice, you know, just how to be present. So S is for, well, it's for both softly staying, like in fish, you know, because we really want to stay present. And so, but there's a gentleness in that. So it's both those words I'm putting in there, softly staying with our attention right here. Beautiful description of what we're trying to do is a relaxed kind of, okay, here I am, softly staying. And then H I've made for the word hold, to like hold whatever. And Y for yes. Yes, squealing microphones, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, unpleasant, yes. Mm-hmm. I can hold that and softly stay with that. It's like meeting our experience, you know. It's receiving our experience, respecting our experience. It's our experience, it's what's coming up. It's the Dharma. Softly stay there, hold it, say yes, that's what's happening. And from that, oh, that's what's happening. Connecting with your truth of whatever it is happening inside you, maybe happening outside you and then inside you. Resistance, the squeal is outside and they're like, oh, okay, yes, there's resistance, that's what's happening. Stay there, softly. Then there's understanding. Then we get to see, and well, this is what's going on. There's an unpleasant scenario, and there's resistance, and it feels like that. It's tension. I don't like feeling that state. Like, oh, yeah, right. We softly stay there, hold that, and we begin to realize, I'm resisting an unpleasantness. That's all that's happening. That's what's really happening. And then we can go like, I can make a fuss about that or not. I can now choose, how do I want to respond next? What do I want to do, cover my ears? This all happens very quickly. But it's a different approach from not realizing what's happening and just, oh no, suddenly we're in tension. Suddenly we're against something. It's happened without we know we're doing it. And then we're saying something unpleasant. And that's what it's like when we aren't being conscious, so shy instead. Okay? Just like that. Any moment. Softly stay with this. It's the wrong order. It should be whatever. Yes. Because it's like, yes, hold, and softly stay. It's actually much more. How it goes, but backwards shy. Shy fish. That's my other mnemonic. Shy fish. Fish are shy. Mostly. We don't like the ones that are bold, but the rest of them are shy. Anyway, I play with words, as you can see. I encourage you to experiment with your own practice and what works for you. What, you know, in what way can you relate to being present and holding your experience and caring about it and giving attention there, waking up? How do you do it? You know, it's all our own way. We have to find our own way. You're not going to do it the same way I do it. You're going to do it what works for you and how, what you remember and what, you know, what your life brings to you. So it's a constant experiment, really, is waking up. So I want to talk this morning more about, I'm going to use some of these quotes, awareness itself, really. I love this image, is that in the, I have images, and sorry, it's just the way my brain is wired. It's like awareness, this shy, wise knowing, is in the back of my skull. So the back part of my brain is sitting back there going like, I see, yeah. The shy, all of those things. And then in the front is all of the activities of seeing this and coming out through my eyes and connecting with this and having comments. Meanwhile, all in the back is like, it's quiet, it's subtle, it's in the back view. It's also in the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere. That's another way of visualizing that whole activity. But this part that's back there that's so easily missed and dismissed and just not noticed, overlooked, is much truer about who we are than the frontal one, which is the loud, noisy one that is so busy and so predominant and so engaging and gets us all gripped up and caught up. And in those moments, it isn't just that the sunset moments, I've called them for a long time, or the rainbow moments, or the post-chocolate moment, feel good. They feel good, but the reason that there's this spiritual urgency or spiritual longing for all of us is because it's the truth of who we are. It doesn't just be pleasant. It's like there's a feeling of home, there's a feeling like, oh, finally. Ah, this is it, feeling. And then, oh no, I've got to do something about it. Grab the telephone and make a photograph of it. Comes in the way, you know. It's like that little activity sort of like supersedes it in a way. But whenever we have those moments, it's like, you can trust that. There's something so profoundly true or trustworthy or right about those states. Those are the states we're longing for and looking for in every activity. All the little busy activities are trying to access those states. They don't do it, but they think they will. You know, they think that the trying will do it. And so this is what, you know, in different traditions they say different things, but our true nature is this quiet knowing. It's not got any feature. It isn't blissful. It isn't, I guess you can say there's calm there, but it's really an absence of any characteristic. It's a very, there aren't words to describe an awakened state. It's simply, the words that are used to describe awakened states are absence of the unawakened things, absence of worry, absence of busyness, absence of commentary, absence of squirminess, absence of need, absence of tension, absence of looking for something else somewhere else. All of the activity, all of the characteristics that we can recognize are activities. And this state is free of that. The state that's our true nature is free. With all of those activities and all those states, there's some degree, and sometimes a huge degree, sometimes a tiny degree, of stressing, of angst, of need. And in those moments, that's not there, so there's a sense of peace, if you like. But they're ordinary. It's an almost, that's what's so, we think that to be awakened or to be enlightened or to have moments of realization, the lights go on, the bells start to ring, you know, the angels start to sing, you know, the symphony starts to chime in, and everything's fantastic, awesome, you know, we use all these words. We're looking for something grand. We're looking for something. The we looking for something is simply what's in the way of the ordinary state that's free from any need. You can't get it. You can't make it. You can't do anything. You are what's stopping it. The you-ing. And so what needs to be addressed as we meditate, we can actually help. And it's an accident, I said this yesterday, it's children from awakening is an accident. Meditation makes us accident prone. Oh, by the way, is anybody here today who wasn't here yesterday? Good morning. Good morning. Welcome. So you sort of have to do catch up, and I'll refer to things that you don't know what I'm talking about. That's okay. You get what you get. I'm glad you're here. Yeah, meditation makes us accident prone. Meditation can alert us when we look there, alert us to all the busy activities that we're doing that are in the way of this true nature. So we can start to see, once we watch the mind's activities. We can see worrying, we can see judging, we can hear whining, you know, we can be aware of this, the strings pulling the puppet show, these activities. The reason meditation isn't so popular is because when you see inside, you'll see a lot of neurosis. You'll see a lot of judging and a lot of criticism, a lot of blaming yourself and a lot of whining and a lot of agitated states, because that's what's going on in there. And the reason that it's not very pleasant to see is, well, partly is that it's costly energetically to whine and complain and judge and worry and all of that. You know, it's not fun. But the real reason we don't want to see it is that we take it personally. And we feel that I'm doing it wrong, and I shouldn't, and oh no, and I can't stand, you know, myself. And so that makes it really unpleasant to look at your stuff. So one of the ways that helps is that you can just remember and sort of think it until that becomes a realization for you, when you don't have to try anymore, is to get that it's just about energy. It's just how survival minds in human bodies have developed. It's not personal. It's the same for everybody. We think if we chase things and get rid of things and rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic, as I've been saying for 15 years, then we'll be okay. And so it's not wrong that we're doing all that. It's just that it isn't that effective for deep well-being. It just clouds that clear awareness, that's all. It's not wrong or bad or stupid. It's just small and limited. But still has to be seen. Because until we see and make conscious our neurosis, I use that word for it, then there's no way of withdrawing our energy in it. We put energy into worries, into judgments, into needs and desires, because we don't realize we're doing it. It's automatic. It's not consciously done. It gets triggered and we have this unconscious reaction of liking this and loathing that. And as long as it's unconscious, it will continue, and we will continue being bound by that reactivity. Once it's conscious, we have some choice. So we have to make it conscious and see what we're doing, what's going on, watch it, watch this process, but not judge it and not make it a problem, just simply keep seeing. Vipassana means insight. See inside. And when you see, that's what you'll see. And you'll mostly see that because we're mostly neurotic, we're mostly caught up. We're not mostly awakened. But we have lots of moments that where we're not caught up. And we start to see that there's much space inside this neurosis. But you won't see those spaces so easily because they're shyer. And they're not so obvious. And what's much more obvious is whining and judging and all of the dramas of the activity. They are what take our attention. And we're very easily attracted to drama, to the loud, to the high, to the low, to the difficult, to the beautiful, to the exciting juice, you know. And we've exaggerated that. Look at our media. We so exaggerate. The most intense, the worst news goes on the front page. You know. The ugliest, the most exciting, the most scary. We keep feeding ourselves intensity. And then we go for a walk in nature for a bit of a relief because it's a little more ordinary. It's not so dramatic out there. And when it is, we talk about it for half an hour. But we get pulled by the dramas. And so we get blinded by them. And then those shyer, ordinary states where there's peacefulness and there's nothing much going on, we kind of think there's nothing much. We dismiss it. So we overlook the moments that we all have all day long, where we're actually free of the self-centeredness and the self-centered strivings and busyness. They're all day. If we didn't have many, many moments all day where things are fine, we'd be dead of exhaustion. Our nervous systems would have fried. They'd have just crashed and gone over the edge long, long ago. So we can heal ourselves and calm ourselves and reassure ourselves and free ourselves by simply being aware of that selfing and the absence of the selfing. But the reason it's difficult to see, partly is it's shy, is subtle, is that we don't have a stability of seeing. Our gaze, our viewfinder, is very jerky. And so it goes to the loud, and goes to the squeaky wheel, and goes to the irritating thing here, and goes to here, and here. But it hasn't learned that stable looking, and just wait and see whatever comes by. And that's why we meditate. That's one of the reasons we meditate, is to stabilize awareness, present awareness. When it stays, you see meing coming, and then disappearing, and then is gone. And there is no meing, there is no tension, there is no noise or no need for anything. And there's then freedom. And then I come in there again, and I'm doing now something, there's an activity going. You're watching this energy rising and passing. But without a stability of being able to see, you can't see anything arise and pass. Something comes and you're with it, and then it's gone, and then you're with the next thing, and we're sort of like engaged. Instead of sitting back in the audience and seeing present awareness, selfing coming, going, anxiety coming, going, sounds coming, going, itches coming, going, sensations coming, going, and we sit back and observe it. The awareness notices this flow of change. You've heard all this 1,000 times before. We none of us say anything new, and how can you say anything new about the same old path of awakening? But we need to keep hearing it and hearing it and hearing it to be reminded. This is just another little reminder, but everything we do, everything we think, everything we do, if you can remember this, it's practice. And so every time you do anything, think anything, say anything, any kind of response to anything, you're getting better at doing it. So every time you judge, you're getting better at judging. Every time you blame yourself, you're getting better at blaming yourself. Every time you're kind, you're getting better at being kind. Everything is growing itself by your energy. So just remember that. Is this helpful? Blame yourself again? I'm getting really good at blaming myself. Do you want to get better at blaming, you know? If you remember it like that, you have some choice. Thich Nhat Hanh says, this is your life. This right here is your life. Don't miss it. Then he says, life is so short, we should all move more slowly. Tibetan Rinpoche, Soyo Rinpoche says, we smother our secret fears of impermanence by surrounding ourselves with more and more goods, more and more things, more and more comforts, only to find ourselves their slaves. All our time and energy is exhausted simply maintaining them. Our only aim in life soon becomes to keep everything as safe and secure as possible. When changes do happen, we find the quickest remedy some slick and temporary solution. And so our life drifts on, unless serious illness or disaster shakes us out of our stupor. Is this relevant? We've been shaken up a little bit recently. We're much more awake, much more engaged. And in 2015, the USA apparently spent $75 billion in self-storage units. That's all that you actually haven't yet thrown away and there isn't room for you in your house. $75 billion. Just so that you know that's what you're doing in this country. Mini storage, that, you know. This is a little quote of the Buddha's that anything that we do which helps disperse the defilements, meaning the things which are the way I function, the meing, wanting, resisting, you know, being agitated, being dismissive, not sure, insecurity, all that. Anything that helps disperse that, that frees us, is the Dharma. Anything that increases this greed, the hatred, the delusion, is not the Dharma. That's all the Buddha taught. The Buddha's teaching, the Buddha Dharma is whatever helps decrease the sense of me. You know this. And this way we make lighter footprints through this life. Oh, this is an interesting thing. I don't remember where I got this, some research somewhere, I can't remember who it was. Unfortunately, I don't always, when I paste and copy things, the author doesn't come along. You know, I told you in the beginning on Friday night that we talked about this Chinese character, which, that's what it is. It's Brother Stendhal Rost, I think his name is. Don't you know who this is? David Stendhal Rost, a beautiful Franciscan monk, talks about gratitude and stuff. He's got TED Talks. And this was he, and he is the one who, that's right, said that the Chinese written character for busy is heart-killing. Mm-hmm. So this is an article, from an article. It talks about the opposite, leisure. Leisure makes time come alive. Our very heartbeat is healthy only when it is leisurely. The heart is a leisurely muscle. It differs from all other muscles. How many push-ups can you make before the muscles in your arms and stomach get so tired that you have to stop? But your heart muscle goes on working for as long as you live. It doesn't get tired because there is a phase of rest built into every single heartbeat. Our physical heart works leisurely. And when we speak of the heart in a wider sense, the idea that life-giving leisure lies at the very center is implied. Never lose sight of that central place of leisure in our life. This would keep us youthful. And what is meditation but taking some space between activity? What about those moments of ordinariness that we can see in between all the activity? Those are the moments of leisure, the walk in the woods, the stopping doing activity, the becoming quiet, the slowing down.
What is his name again, please?
So his name is Brother David Stendhal Rost. So it's something like S-T-E-N-D-L hyphen, I think it's R-A-A-S-T, something like that. And gratitude. If you put in any of those words, in even misspelled, you'll find him. This continues. This is still his. C.S. Lewis echoed this beautifully in his memorable meditation on friendship, where he argued that things like philosophy, art, the universe itself have no survival value, but are among those things which give value to survival. Reframed in this way, leisure reveals itself as precisely one of those things, not a luxury of life, but an essential vitalizer of it. And Albert Einstein, even though he apparently wasn't a philosopher, nevertheless says some brilliant things. He says this: the human being is part of a whole called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space, but the human being. He experiences himself, his thoughts, his feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and affection for just a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circles of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Could have been the Buddha who said that. Optical delusion of consciousness that's imprisoning us. That's exactly what that separate little unpleasant little thing is. And it's a perception. It isn't real. It's simply the way we perceive, and perception changes. And all day long it keeps changing. We're imprisoned and we're not imprisoned, and we're imprisoned and we're not imprisoned. And you can observe it for yourself. And by making conscious those little quiet, subtle periods when we're not imprisoned, we're practicing that. And it becomes more and more accessible. We continue to widen our awareness into this sense of spaciousness, the non-prison, developing expansiveness. When we're able to sit in the midst of whatever is unfolding, we have tremendous power and tremendous relief. So it doesn't matter what's happening. That's not Einstein, that's some Tibetan person. Mm-hmm. And Dogen, Zen patriarch, once we realize that the nature of our existence, true nature, right, is beyond thought and emotions, that it's incredibly vast and interconnected with all other beings, the separation, the fear, and the hopes fall away. It's a tremendous relief. A sunset moment's a tremendous relief. Is it not? What we need to simply do is be more conscious of those moments. They're not different, they're not later, they're not like you don't have it and someone else has it. They're available all the time. They're so close, they're so simple, they're so subtle, it's so easy that we miss it. It's so also essential and important and significant that we don't appreciate that, so we overlook it. It's much simpler and closer and easier to be free in any moment than we realize. We're waiting for something after another 100 days of retreat and another 10 more teachers and, you know, the kids have to leave and I have to get over the flu and all. There's always something in the way. And we're just putting up all these barriers for ourselves all the time, thinking that it's bigger and more dramatic and there's no way I'm qualified for it yet and or whatever the reasons are. It's already possible and we're already experiencing these moments. We just are overlooking them, not appreciating them. This is that the man I mentioned the other night on Friday night, Rupert Spira. I've only just encountered him. Somebody, a friend of mine, gave me his name, so I looked him up, and I have a few of the things he said. Again, he's just exactly speaking about the same topic. Whatever. Where are we going here? An imagined limitation. Self is this imagined limitation. It's assumed by us. These are just sketchy notes I've written, so it doesn't read very well. There's no real separate self that leaves and then that returns. There's only ever awareness, which covers itself in form and thinking and feeling and seems to appear as other than itself. From this point of view, the separate sense of self, I've got to make sense of this, these are my notes and I should have rewritten it in a way that I can actually read. When we have a moment of realization that the separate sense of self is simply perception and it isn't reality, in that moment, you absolutely know that. You know perfectly well that it's a perception and not a real thing. Once you have a moment of that realization, and you can't unknow that. You forget it, but you don't unknow it. You know, oh, that I'm lost in the game again. Oh, I'm believing that self again. But somewhere in the background, you know perfectly well it's a game that's being played in the mind. Until you've had that glimpse, you don't believe it. It's just words. But once you've had a moment of actually, there is no real self here. It's just the way my mind congeals at times. It's so habituated, it's so familiar that it seems this is the only way, is to be a separate sense of self. That's what we identify with and that's where our energy is occupied with. But when we start taking this quiet, waiting, shy practice that we're doing, that's why that you're accident prone. You're much more likely to realize that when the selfing comes in, you see it come in and you see it. It's just the way the mind is turned. It isn't that there is a self now that's suddenly here that was gone. You'll see that that's true for yourself. There's just thoughts and ideas and feelings that come, and then they go away again. He says there's nothing special about awareness. No elation, no expansion. There's nothing, it's normal. It's not new, it's not awesome. It's already a known experience. It's our true nature. We have them all day long. He said something he said about himself. I realized that I was always shining and free, but I just forgot. So obvious that it's overlooked, so intimate and so well known. It's not extraordinary. As long as we expect enlightenment in the future, we're expecting a particular event. Awakening isn't an event. It's not an objective experience, not something that happens when we stop expecting anything. When we understand this, we stop expecting anything. So his practice is turn our attention to the experience of being me and watch it. And what will happen is you'll see thoughts, sensations, ideas, comments coming and going and remaining in behind the whole thing, awareness. Just watch that process. And so that's what we're going to do today. That will do for talking. Is anybody confounded by what I've said? Has anybody got a question? We make it complicated. We complicate everything. We clutter everything up. We, the separate we, who's trying to be free and happy, gets in the way of being free and happy. So it's poignant. And it's called ignorance, and it's not wrong or bad. And this, I think, and I've said it so many times, and many of you heard me, that I love about Buddhism and the way the Buddha was, is totally not judging the fact that we have these separate senses of selves, which are our problem. It's simply called ignorance. It's not sin. We're not going to burn in hell. We're burning in hell every time we're not free and easy. It's not that there's worse somewhere else. That's not the way the Buddha taught. He said simply, with ignorance, there's suffering. When we see truly what we're doing, what's causing distress, it gets seen through and it just doesn't get activated because we realize it's not helpful, causes more distress. The more we see that, the more we understand how that is, because we see it working in ourselves, for ourselves, not because someone else is telling us anything. We keep withdrawing our attention in doing these neurotic, costly things. As soon as we realize, and we start realizing it quicker and quicker, so we withdraw attention there more and more quickly. And this is how meditation works. It's because it's during our meditation is when we're actually being self-reflective and watching the mind and calming down and stabilizing the attention, this present awareness, accessing this quiet knowing. We start to see what happens for ourselves in our own way. That's all. So, let's wake up, shall we? We'll take, it's 22.